into our discussion on eugenics and the British contribution to them. And we're going to be talking about modern eugenics today, but really talking about modern eugenics of the 20th century. We'll get to the 21st century when we near the end of this series. So we'll start with the idea of a modern project for improving the human population through selective breeding was originally developed by Francis Galton and was initially inspired by Darwinism and its theory of natural selection. Galton had read his half-cousin Charles Darwin's theory of evolution, which sought to explain the development of plant and animal species and desired to apply it to humans. Based on his biographical studies, Galton believed that desirable human qualities were hereditary traits based on Darwin's research. In 1883, 1 year after Darwin's death, Galton gave his research a name: eugenics. Now, I don't really go in for the theory of evolution and the changing of one being into another being, but there certainly are adaptive changes that occur, and you certainly get breeding patterns, and people will try to breed to improve the stock. I mean, people will try to marry up, as it were. We are programmed to find people attractive. We're programmed to find beauty attractive. We look for the most intelligent people, people with a strong physique, people with symmetrical faces, which shows that that they don't have defective genes. And it used to be that anybody that actually survived to adulthood would have a healthy immune system. And of course, that has changed, and that is all a part of Darwinism, and also the, as it says here, the survival of the fittest. So you want to encourage the most fit people to breed so that they're going to survive. And also included in this was the fact that the different races of man are competing against one another. We are competing against one another for resources, for limited space. And this in particular was seen back then as this was a competition between the races, and they defined it as between superior races and inferior races, which, as we've said, is probably wasn't such a good idea. And as Max has pointed out, we should be pointing to desirable traits and undesirable traits. I think wasn't that the way that you put it, Max? Desirable and undesirable last week.
Yes, I think so. That is a way of describing what eugenics is all about without using language that could be regarded as offensive, I suppose.
And Sir Francis Galton, we've talked about before. We've had him in our Greatest Britons. So if people want to find out more about him, you can go there. And he was really the guy that started all this off with eugenics. As we've already heard, there were these eugenic policies that were implemented in the ancient world, but it wasn't actually given a name. It was Galton that gave this new science a name: eugenics. The statistician and explorer Francis Galton, 1822 to 1911, was a cousin of Charles Darwin, and in common with other thinkers from this time, began to apply Darwin's theories of natural selection to the human race. In its, well, in particular, the group that he was a part of, which was the British nation. In its early years, eugenics was dominated by a small and esoteric elite group, which sought scientifically to establish ideas about inherited characteristics and abilities that were closely linked to social class and race. Concerns over the size and fitness of the population were not new, and the backdrop for the growth of eugenics was a period of enormous social and economic change. And I guess they're looking at social class here. They would be looking at the working classes and people that didn't work so much. Maybe they were thinking, well, perhaps we wouldn't need so many of these people. I mean, in the past, what they did, they would round those people up and they would send them off to Australia or to America, where they could then make new lives for themselves and help settle a new country and make something of themselves. I mean, that was the thought that went behind it. But the actual result of it was that if somebody, you know, got caught catching a sheep or whatever because they were starving, the next thing they knew, they were rounded up and sent off to Australia. Or if they happened to live in the Highlands, they were put on these ships and sent off to America to work as an indentured servant, as a slave. And in this time, sort of 1890, we weren't doing that. And we also had this increase in the population because of the advances that we'd actually made in medical technology. So I think this probably played into it. And this idea about social class and race, these inherited characteristics and abilities, they also looked at different races. They looked at black Africans and saw that they didn't have much in the way of civilization in their history. And then they looked at white people and the history of civilization that we have. And that played into this as well. And they said, well, obviously, we want to have more white people than black people. So they weren't actually separating it as, well, what you should really want is the very best examples of black people and the very best examples of white people. What they were looking at was what we want is more white people and less black people, particularly in America, where you had this multicultural, a multicultural country. And when birth control came in, there was this, it was encouraged amongst blacks, I think, wasn't it, to get sterilized, or and also abortion was promoted amongst them. Any thoughts on this, Max?
I think that some people will be of the opinion that the eugenics argument is now outdated, and that there are people that claim that there is a sort of there is human equality, and so that therefore there is no need to have eugenics. But in fact, everything, every scientific study that's ever been done has demonstrated that there are inequalities between individuals within racial groups, and also on average between racial groups there are inequalities as well. And the thing that that you were mentioning there about the tendency that there was in Europe during the 1800s to round up people who were regarded as vagrants or who were regarded as homeless and therefore surplus populations. There was a tendency to round people up that were in that unfortunate situation and send them off to the New World, to Australia, to South Africa and New Zealand to build up the white populations in those countries. And people may well think, well, that was a historic imperative that no longer exists today. But the fact of the matter is that the massive population imperative facing our world today also sort of coincides with the climate crisis, which is that the climate crisis largely is being not necessarily entirely caused by, but the climate crisis is being antagonized or exacerbated by the population growth that is taking place around the world, primarily in the third world countries. And there is a great need, unless mankind is to become is to be prevented from sustaining our civilization as a result of overcrowding. Because if we achieve a situation where the earth becomes so overcrowded that spending on things like science has to be curtailed, that spending on social services have to be curtailed, and so we end up with a situation where there are where the average wealth across the world starts to decline, and where the average health around the world starts to decline, not only in third world developing countries but also in the developed parts of the world as well. If that starts to happen, then it will be a very difficult downward spiral for us to get ourselves out. And a number of great thinkers of the current era have stated that the next big step for mankind is for us to start to colonize other planets. And for us to get to a situation where we can practically start to colonize other planets, there is a lot of developmental work that needs to be done with regard to space travel. And in my view, that is an area where there needs to be a tremendous amount of additional investment. Because if we don't have that additional investment, the situation could be reached where eventually the population of the world is so great that the distribution of the world's wealth is so thinly spread that it then becomes impossible for governments to actually provide the funding for interplanetary travel, in which case we'll be trapped on the Earth, and we'll then be in a situation where we'll have a a maximum population that will be disproportionately composed of those current populations of the Earth that have achieved the least in terms of developing culture and civilization, and that will be a very unfortunate situation to develop. And what we need is for governments to make the money available to develop space travel. And, you know, thankfully, there are people like Elon Musk who are putting their wealth into developing this sort of thing as well. Because if we can start to colonize other planets, then that will be a major step forward in terms of the resources that are available. If you talk to people who are extremely worried by the climate crisis, what they'll tell you is that, you know, that humanity as a whole at the moment is consuming too much, that we are consuming so much that we would need 2.4 planets or whatever to planet Earth to support us. Well, in that case, we just need to find another two planet Earths in order for us to then have scope where we can continue to expand. And any living thing, and a population of people is a living thing, any living thing needs to be able to grow. If you stop something from growing, if you try to stop a human being from growing, then they will die. If you try and stop a tree from growing, the tree will die. And it's the same with every living thing, whether it's an individual living thing or whether it's a population of people. If you try to stop the population from expanding, the population will eventually suffer from various diseases and things that will mean that the population will regress and eventually be replaced. And so it is vital for the future of mankind, whether you view the future of mankind as being something which is nationally oriented or whether you regard it as internationally oriented, this is something which must come.
Yeah, if you look at the population figures for Africa at the moment, they're about 1.34 billion and that's predicted to go to 2.5 billion by 2050. So that is predicted to double. And then if you actually look at white people and white people's average, we're not even making enough people to replicate ourselves, to cover ourselves when we have people dying. So you have people from Black Africa that are going to double in size to 2.5 billion, and you have white people that are going down in size. And of course, if you look at Africa, what it actually produces for itself, a lot of Africa relies upon food aid and charity. So it's just going to increase the numbers. So you can understand this drive to bring family planning and contraception to Africa. But of course, you've still got the mindset there that you need to have a large family in order to look after you when you get old, because you haven't got a welfare system. So because we haven't introduced eugenics and encouraged it in places like Africa, we are setting up problems for ourselves in the future with the number of people that there are going to be around. And of course, as you say there, Max, that's going to reduce the ability of mankind to do things such as space exploration and the amount of resources there are that go on that. Well, getting back to our notes here, the eugenics movement in Britain was complex and crossed party political divides, but was most evident in the work of two organisations formed in the early 20th century, the Francis Galton Laboratory for National Eugenics and the Eugenics Society. So this was not a right-wing idea, this was not a nationalist idea, this was a scientific idea that was accepted all across the party political divides. You had people in the Labour Party, people in the Conservative Party, right wing, left wing, and they all understood the benefits of increasing the numbers of people who were the most fittest. But obviously, that if you have more clever people in your nation, it's going to produce more geniuses. If you end up with people that have more immune resistance, it's going to cost the nation less in medicine. And everything is going to improve. So this wasn't a right-wing idea or a left-wing idea. It was basically a sensible idea. Eugenicists, also known as eugenists, believed they were applying scientific solutions to social problems. Most of Galton's practical eugenic suggestions were for so-called positive eugenics, the improvement of the race by encouraging those couples deemed worthy to have larger families. However, others were more interested in negative eugenics, seeking by various means to control the reproduction of the unfit. Such ideas were widely taken up by social scientists, politicians, and other public figures, as well as those involved in medicine and the sciences. And this was just accepted by everybody, pretty much. And Francis Galton was at the front of this. And of course, as we've seen before, Francis Galton was an incredibly intelligent man. He was a polymath, and he was really leading this movement. And they believed that this would, it says here, the improvement of the race. I mean, they're talking about the whole of humanity. They were hoping would be improved by these policies. Max, any thoughts?
Yeah, you're absolutely right there. And it's interesting that if you look at other sort of thinkers during the 20th century, H.G. Wells, for example, wrote about the need to improve the human stock in his book Anticipations. Founder of Mensa, the High IQ Society, Raymond Cattell, he was a great supporter of eugenics, and in fact went to the extent of creating or devising a science-based religion called Beyondism in order to promote his ideas. And then from Sir Francis Galton, there were a number of people who were his proteges, who, for example, Carl Pearson, who then went on to continue continue Galton's work, rather. And so it initially was a science that transcended the political boundaries, as you say. And it was only at the end of the Second World War, when eugenics was attacked because the Nazis had promoted eugenics and had believed in eugenics. As a result of that, and as a result of public opinion turning against National Socialist Germany, it then meant that eugenics had a very difficult time and became unfashionable. But my belief is that eugenics is starting to become more fashionable again. More people are starting to talk about this because people are realizing the intelligent people who study climate change and the climate change crisis are realizing that it is population growth that is the issue, and that it is the need, or the perceived need, to uplift the populations of the third world to the same standard of wealth that's enjoyed by people in the developed nations, that is seen as being the massive driver towards the cutting down of renewable resources, or not renewable resources, the mining of minerals, the cutting down of trees, the reduction of the rainforest, and all this sort of thing. All that is being driven by the economic need to try to lift the standard of living of people in the third world up to the same level as the standard of living of people that live in the developed world. And so eugenics again is coming to the fore, because people are realizing that the reason why the standard of living the developed world is higher than it, and massively higher than it is in the developing world, and that it was and still is to some extent amongst the sort of peripheral populations that have remained unchanged since the Stone Age, and that is down to average intelligence and within those populations, and that there is a need to drive up the average intelligence of people from third world countries.
Yeah, it certainly can't be a bad thing, can it, to have more intelligent people in these third world countries, more people that are capable of inventing things and managing things in better ways, developing better ways of doing things for their nation. Getting back to the early 20th century here, when in 1907 Galton stepped down as director of the Eugenics Record Office, which he had helped to found at University College London, the statistician Carl Pearson accepted his request to take over. Pearson renamed it the Galton Laboratory for National Eugenics and became the first Galton Professor of Eugenics at UCL. Through the journal Biometrica, with which Galton and Pearson were closely involved, the school promoted the study of biometrics, or mathematical genetics. Pearson also set up the Annals of Eugenics in 1925, and Carl Pearson we also had as one of our greatest Britons, and people can look that up. And I think this study of biometrics, statistics also came into this, and it was the measurement of parts of the body and looking at averages. Am I correct in thinking that, Max?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, one of the studies that Carl Pearson undertook was to work with the prison service and to measure the height of prisoners over a very long period of time. And what he deduced from that is that the average person declines in height by approximately an inch by the time they reach age 60, and then they drop by another inch for every decade that they live beyond age 60. And this is an actual fact. I believe that's why sort of colloquially people refer to little old ladies and little old men, because by the time people become old ladies and old men, they are littler than they were before. And in some cases, if they happen to be fairly short to begin with, they're sort of very short by the time they reach their sort of twilight years. And so those kind of measurements had never been done before. And so people, you know, were completely oblivious to the fact that it happens to everybody, that everybody gets shorter as time goes by, as they age, rather, I should say. And there are numerous other, perhaps more scientific and more sort of medicine-based reasons for biometrica and for measuring differences between individuals.
Well, you can predict things much easier, can't you? And you can also, if you see something and you think, well, that's quite common, is it just me? Is it just an anecdote that I'm quite used to seeing that? And then you can do as many measurements as you can of an average of the population, and then you can see whether that thing that you noticed is actually common to everybody. And then from that, you can make predictions. So, you know, it was a very good idea to start measuring things and compiling these statistics. And this journal, Biometrica, it used to collect them. I think Biometrica is still going, although it now has a different role to play, obviously, because eugenics have been given a bad name since the Second World War. Well, Pearson's eugenic ideas were based on so-called racist science that called for the creation of a, quote, homogeneous white race whose fertility shall markedly dominate that of the black, close quote. He held similar views on discouraging reproduction among the unthrifty, the mentally defective, and the criminal, the tramp, and the congenital pauper, insisting that the right to live did not confer the right to reproduce. And it's these notes here that are actually conflating the unthrifty, the mentally defective, criminal, tramp, and congenital pauper with the comment that it says before about encouraging whites and their fertility to markedly dominate that of the black. And if you are thinking in terms of races, clearly you're going to want your race to be superior. You're going to want your race to make it to the top. And that's what they were thinking about here. But this talking about the unthrifty, the mentally defective, the criminal, the tramp, and the congenital pauper, I mean, surely that's good ideas. You don't want the mentally defective to be reproducing. You don't want more mentally defective. You don't want more criminals. And the reason why they're saying these things, because, I mean, some people might look at that and they might say, but isn't that an individual thing? I mean, somebody might become a tramp. Somebody might become a criminal, but they actually discovered through doing these statistics and through doing these measurements that things such as criminality were passed down through the family. And that's why you get these crime families that you hear of. And alcoholism, that works its way through the family as well. And their general idea was, you know, it's not good to be an alcoholic. Surely it would be much better for you to be born into a body that doesn't have a predisposed disposition to becoming an alcoholic, so that you actually have the best tools to start out with, as it were. And that was the mentality behind this. And that's the way we should look at it, I think. We should, rather than looking at it as somebody wasn't able to be born, you should be thinking, well, no, that person was able to be born, but they were able to be born into a healthy body with a healthy mind, so that they could actually make the most of what it means to be a human being. So these were these ideas that they had. And obviously they're trying to say, well, this is all racist here. It's actually by English Heritage, these notes that I'm actually getting from here, and also Wikipedia. So they call it racist science. But it was basically science that they had done that showed that mentally defectives, unthrifty, criminals, tramps, and congenital paupers, it's something that is inheritable, and it is passed down through your parents, just the same as positive traits such as being a good musician, being highly intelligent. All those sorts of things are passed down the line from your parents as well, but also these negative things. And this final point here is saying that the right to live did not confer the right to reproduce. Now, we look at everything today as if we're all individuals and the individual is completely separate from everybody else. And that's not actually possible. The individual relies upon everybody else for everything. From the moment we're born to the moment we die, we rely on everybody else in the people group to provide things for us and all the ancestors before. So that was the way that they were looking at things back then. And they were saying, well, just because you were born doesn't give you the right to reproduce, because what you are going to be reproducing could be a burden to all these other people that are around you. And what we want to do is improve the situation for the next generation, not make the situation worse. So again, it wasn't about limiting the individual's rights. It was about improving things for the group. Max, any thoughts?
It isn't all about necessarily encouraging certain people to have a larger population, a greater reproduction rate, and other people to have a slower reproduction rate. One of the things that was quite an important social factor during the early part of the 20th century was alcoholism caused by the effects of the First World War. Lots of soldiers that came back from the First World War suffered from PTSD, and PTSD wasn't recognized in those days, and lots of those soldiers turned to alcohol in order to kind of drown their sorrows. Also, lots of women whose husbands had been sent off to the front, worried, they also turned to alcoholism, there was less care taken over the alcohol content of alcoholic drinks and things in those days, and so there were quite a large number of women who became alcoholic while they were bearing children, and as a result of their alcoholism, their children were then born either brain damaged or with certain psychological conditions that were caused by the mother's alcoholism. And so a lot of the work that was done by the Eugenics Society, you know, eugenics meaning good birth, was around preventing alcoholism amongst pregnant women publicizing and making information available about alcoholism to the population generally around about that time.
Yeah, it's shocking, really, when you think about it, the damage that's caused by alcoholism to the descendants. And it's the same with drugs as well. People are addicted to drugs. That then gets passed on down through to the children. Well, Pearson was succeeded as Galton Professor of Eugenics in 1933 by Sir Ronald Aylmer Fisher. Fisher was, in 1911, a founding member of the Cambridge Eugenics Society, whose members included John Maynard Keynes. Like Galton and Pearson, Fisher applied statistical analysis to problems in the evolution of man and was a leading biostatistician and geneticist. Fisher continued to support eugenics even after the Second World War, by which time it was tainted by association with the genocidal consequences of Nazi race science. Obviously, they're using inflammatory language there. But what we can see here is that this idea about eugenics, which was thought up by very, very intelligent people, is now spreading across the country. And we now have a second eugenics society, which is being formed at Cambridge, one of our finest universities. And what they're talking about here is statistical analysis. So, you know, modern day researchers historians will refer to this as racist science, but it was statistical analysis. I mean, it was facts that they were discovering here. It wasn't propaganda that they were putting out. It wasn't hatred of a color of a skin or anything like that. It was statistical analysis, and it was pattern recognition, and it was attempts to improve the lives of everyone. And of course, today they'll say, oh yes, but it wasn't improving the lives of these individuals that were sterilized or what have you. But as Max has pointed out, if you just encourage them to have one child instead of two, and you encourage the people with the more desirable traits to have two children instead of one, then gradually those numbers would reduce of the people that actually had these less desirable characteristics, and the numbers would increase of those that had the desirable characteristics. So we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We should remember that this is based upon science. It's based upon statistics, pattern recognition, and trying to improve the lives of the whole, rather than just, you know, selfishly improving the lives of the individual and just thinking of the individual, actually thinking about the whole group that the individual is a member of. Any thoughts to add to that, Max?
Well, I think if you look at the body of work that's been produced by Carl Pearson, he produces two books which I have got copies of, which are very interesting. One of which is entitled National Life from the Standpoint of Science. And so effectively what he's trying to do is to create a body of thought where people are basing their thoughts with regard to the government of a nation based upon science and proven scientific principles in order to make the population as high a quality population as possible, in order to make the nation as vigorous a nation as it could possibly be, and in order to improve its wealth and its capacity effectively. Also, another book that he produced was The Moral Basis of Socialism. And so he was both a nationalist and a socialist, and his Moral Basis of Socialism effectively describes the onus placed upon the people who have the greatest abilities, the people who have the most desirable characteristics. There's onus upon them to take responsibility for and care for the people who are less fortunate, and to try to model society so that those people that are less fortunate are looked after, but also so that the overall management of society is such that it incorporates eugenic principles, and so each successive generation will be improved upon the last.
Yeah, as we were saying before, it's neither right wing nor left wing, and Pearson was a socialist. Well, I think we should probably leave that here for this week, Max, and we'll continue on with that next week. So thank you very much for coming on today.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.